So tonight we take a little journey through challenges to the law of offer and acceptance, or traditional contract law meets contemporary American reality, or something like that. And we start with Judge Easterbrook. We go back to Procy v. versus Eidenberg. By the way, there is now a version which I think finally works, as far as I can tell, that's posted and linked to our site to on the blog page. So if you'd like to watch the rest of it, it's worth watching, particularly some of his comments about what the oral argument was like in front of Judge Easterbrook and the other members of that panel. Professor Whitford asks David Austin what it was like to argue before the Seventh Circuit in that argument, after David Austin explained that he didn't really want to argue, and he had actually induced Matt Seidenberg to hire another lawyer to do the appeal. He had won below from the Christian court, and Procedee was appealing. The other lawyer wrote the brief, and then at the last minute he bailed out. He said he wasn't going to argue this case before the Seventh Circuit. He may have been scared away by the forces that were mounted on the other side, but we don't know why, but he just refused to argue. So David Austin, who, remember, had just graduated from law school, had never argued before an appellate court in his life. Was not that exercise, which is common here, was not part of Northeastern's education at the time he was there. He had to get up and argue it. And Whitford said, "What is it like? What was it like?" And he said, "It was the worst day of my life." That's what he said. I think Whitford had said, "Well, as an existential experience, what was it like?" And he said, "As an existential experience, it was the worst day of my life." He said, "The only way I could describe the oral argument was that I was subjected to a hazing," which is how he described the questioning, almost entirely from Judge Easterbrook. Now, Judge Easterbrook was a law professor for most of his life at the University of Chicago. And folks who were at Chicago at that time tell me he was not a terribly nice fellow. So I take that. I'll take that, accept that as the truth. What I care about here is just how terrible an opinion this is. I don't mean the way it comes out. Maybe it comes out the right way. But all these decisions, what I want us to look at tonight is the quality of the legal work that was being done. How good or bad a job was the judge doing at legal analysis? Not rhetoric. You know, all judges, all lawyers can do rhetoric. From your examinations, I'll tell you, some of you can do rhetoric. But the problem is to make legal arguments, which is really a different kind of ballgame. So let's examine Easterbrook's legal arguments. First of all, we can take an overall look at what he had to say about contract formation before we get into some of his analogies. When was the contract formed? We went over a little bit of this last class. It's important to do it again. When was the contract formed?
When Seidenberg did not return.
When is that? Yeah, we don't know. I mean, this was not even a case where the contract document, such as it was, said you have 10 days to return it. So then we could say, well, at the expiration of 10 days, he had not returned it, and therefore he had. So we have a problem to begin with. Now, it's true that the Uniform Commercial Code says in 2204 that the time of making is not an important concern. We don't have to refuse to enforce it because we're not exactly sure when it's made. But we have to have a concept of what the act of acceptance would be. And traditional contract law is perfectly clear. What would the act of acceptance be? The act of offer was proceeds offering it for sale, in this case in a store. What's the act of acceptance? When do you think you've bought something in that store?
When you pay for it.
When you pay for it. I think that's what we all think. We think when we pay for it, we bought it. Now, there are circumstances under which we have a right to return things and get our money back. So we haven't studied any of those, but let's try it. Let's try it by extension of what we do know about contract law. How should a court understand a provision in an offer which says that if you buy it from me and you don't like it, you have the right to return it? What is that? As a matter of contract law. Does it mean that buying it, paying for it, is not acceptance? What does it mean?
Is it like a form of rejection?
Well, but it's not, is it? Let's take that for a second. One of the things that Easterbrook refers to is a set of provisions in the Uniform Commercial Code which says this, that a seller delivers a good to the buyer, that the buyer has the right to inspect the goods to determine whether or not they are conforming goods. That is, they're what they ordered. If they are not conforming goods, they then have a right to reject the goods. Now, there's only one problem with that as an analogy to what's going on here. And that is, you notice what I said. I said that this is a process that takes place before acceptance of the goods. Not of the contract, but of the goods. So what we have is, we have a contract. We have the seller and the buyer. The seller is going to deliver goods to the buyer. They make a contract for the purchase of the goods. It has various terms in it. Price, quantity, warranties, whatever. Now the goods are delivered by the seller to the buyer. This is the seller's performance of the contract. The buyer, the Uniform Commercial Code says, and it's true, it uses the term acceptance, but it's not talking about accepting an offer. That happened here. Now what's happening is that the seller is performing. When the seller delivers the goods to the buyer has a chance to inspect them. The mere fact that they're offloaded off the truck onto the landing dock, onto the landing platform, does not mean that the buyer has accepted those goods from the standpoint of the Uniform Commercial Code. They have a right to inspect them. If once they inspect them, they decide they're non-conforming goods, that is, that the seller has breached his contract, the buyer can then reject the goods. When the buyer notifies the seller of rejection, the seller has to take them back. Now, if the seller thinks that those goods really are conforming goods, the seller can sue the buyer for breach of contract, of course. And we're going to learn a little bit later on that under the code, if the seller wants to, quote, cure, that is, the seller says, okay, well, I'm going to deliver different goods to you that will conform, that under a variety of circumstances that we'll study, the seller has the right to cure. They can make another effort to deliver goods to the buyer, and this time if they deliver the stuff that's conforming, the buyer has to accept them, and if they don't accept the goods, then they will have breached the contract. The code actually goes on a little beyond that, and it says that there are cases in which, there are circumstances in which, if the seller inspects the goods, doesn't see anything wrong with them, and so starts to use them. Well, once they start to use them, that's an act of acceptance. They don't have to say the words. It's an act of acceptance. The goods are theirs now. But now they discover they're no good. Well, what they would like to do is to revoke their active acceptance of the goods, and under limited circumstances, they can do that. But all of this has to do with provisions the Uniform Commercial Code introduces, having to do with performance and breach, not with contract formation. So that reference that Easterbrook, and he sort of knows that, right? He does something really weird. Over on page 669, top of the page, when he talks about, quote, acceptance of goods, he does say, he understands it's not really applicable. We refer to 266 only to show that the opportunity to return goods can be important. Acceptance of an offer differs from acceptance of goods after delivery. Yes, Judge, it sure does. It sure is different. But that's not good enough because you're still using it as part of your argument. But the UCC consistently permits the parties to structure their relations so the buyer's a chance to make a final decision after detailed review. Not of the contract, Judge, but of the goods. So that is to say that, let's say, that Zeidenberg buys the box of ProCD software and he brings it home, he sticks it in his computer, and it's a bad disk. I've bought them, maybe you have too, just doesn't boot. Okay. He takes that back to the store. Does he have a right to do that? Absolutely. What is that called? Under the code, that's a rejection of the goods as non-conforming. But that's not what this case is about. This case has nothing to do with that. Sorry, Easterbrook. It's just wrong. There is a story, and I have no idea whether it's true or not, that several years after Easterbrook handed this decision down, he was at some sort of conference, and one of the people at the conference was a person who was his clerk that year. And the clerk reportedly came over to Judge Easterbrook and said, Judge, this has been on my conscience ever since I clerked for you. I want you to know that that was a terrible decision. Whether that's a true story or not, I don't know. So that argument is totally specious. But he gets to that only after a whole series of examples that he wants to give that I'd like to examine briefly. That's on page 667. Transactions in which the exchange of money precedes the communication of detailed terms are common. Consider the purchase of insurance. I love the use of insurance as an example, by the way. There's no field of which the law has more often decided to deviate from traditional contract principles than the field of insurance, largely against insurance companies, largely. So he talks about insurance. He talks about, buying a travel ticket for airline. Traveler calls the carrier or an agent, is quoted a price, reserves a seat, pays, gets a ticket in that order. Ticket contains elaborate terms, which the traveler can reject by canceling the reservation. To use the ticket is to accept the terms, or he talks about Carnival Cruise Lines that had a similar decision. Concert tickets, I love this. The back of the ticket states that the patron promises not to record the concert. To attend is to agree. A theater that detects a violation will confiscate the tape and escort the violator to the exit. One could arrange things so that every concert goer signs his promise before forking over the money, but it's cumbersome and therefore would lengthen queues and then raise prices, would scotch the sale of tickets by phone or electronic data service. Consumer goods work the same way. Okay, I get the argument. The argument is it gets in the way of doing business. Oh, that's a good legal argument. Yes, the law of offer and acceptance frequently gets in the way of doing business. It gets in the way of doing business by giving the offeree the opportunity to reject the offer if the offeree doesn't like the terms. So, what this case stands for then is that the judge thinks this is a reasonable way of doing business. And he can't figure out how business could otherwise be done. That's what this opinion says. That's what page 667 says. Consumer goods works the same way. Suppose someone who wants to buy a radio set visits a store, pays, and walks out with a box. And inside the box is a leaflet containing some terms, the most important of which usually is the warranty, read for the first time in the comfort of home. By Zeidenberg's lights, the warranty in the box is irrelevant. Every consumer gets the standard warranty implied by the UCC in the event the contract is silent. Yet, so far as we are aware, no state disregards warranties furnished with consumer products. Well, that's just not true. It's just not true. The law is, in fact, all over the place on this subject. And courts are not sure what to do. And he's right that it's a similar problem. He's wrong, by the way, at saying that that's the most important limitation in the box that you bring home. The most important limitation in the box that you bring home is the provision which says that you have to arbitrate, you may not sue. That's the most important provision. Now, that's particularly true in Massachusetts, because in Massachusetts, that provision about you don't get a warranty is of no force and effect. Because when the Massachusetts legislature passed Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code, they said, you cannot disclaim the implied warranty of merchantability for consumer goods. So much for that. You know, and people do business anyway in Massachusetts, as far as I can tell, same way they do it in every other state. So here's the problem. The problem is that traditional contract law says that when you accept an offer, you accept the offer that you know was made to you. He accepted the offer when he bought the goods and went home. If we want to limit his use of that software, we've got to find some other theory upon which to do that. Now, the ProCD tried, and every seller of software tries, and that's that they never call it a sale. Do you think you buy software? You don't. Take a look at the language of every offer that's made, and incidentally, what it says on the box. You license the software. You license the software. You don't buy it. Now, courts have different views about what in the world that means, but that's what it says. I'll give you an extreme case. There is some software, there are some software licenses which say that you may not sell the software to anybody else. I'm not talking about making a copy of it. That would violate the copyright law in any event. You may not sell it to anybody else. That's a right that actually copyright does not give to an author. If you go out and buy a book at Barnes & Noble, Borders, your local bookstore, and take it home and you read it, now you're finished with it, you say, this is the one I'm not going to read again, you can sell it. The Copyright Act says you can sell it. It's called the right of first sale. you could sell it. Courts decided that first, and then Congress of the United States included it in the Copyright Act. Why doesn't that apply? Oh, because when you bought the book, you bought the book. But when you buy the software, you don't buy the software, you license the software. You buy the physical media on which the software is recorded. That's if there's still a disk. There aren't too many of those around. Mostly we download software now. There's no media, so you don't own anything. Well, so we could argue that, well, license is an entirely different body of law than contract law, and we can make up different rules for license law, but that's not the way the law has developed so far. It just isn't. So calling it a license doesn't really explain it. Well, that's a dilemma. What things are we going to allow to be done then? What are we going to allow to be put in the box and then treat it as though it were a term of the contract? We have no logical explanation for why it's part of the contract. Now, what Easterbrook has tried to do, and he invented this, by the way, is he's tried to say, I'm going to come back to the question I raised when I started. He says, oh, well, you see, he had a right to return it. And then you notice in Hill versus Gateway, he does that again. At least in Procedee versus Eidenberg, there was actually some language on the outside of the box, although apparently in minuscule type, which said subject to license contained herein or something like that. But it didn't say what the limitation was. On the Gateway box, has anybody ever bought a Gateway computer? Because they have great boxes. What's on their box?
It looks like a cow.
Cows! Cows, yes, silhouettes of cows. A beautiful box. I love the box. I don't love the computer, but I love the box. It's a great box, but it says nothing on it. I think the word Gateway is on it, but it says nothing else. So, first he says, oh, well, that's just a shipping container. Well, every box is a shipping container. What does that explain? Then he says, oh, well, it's okay because, you see, they have a right to send it back within 30 days. They can actually use it for 30 days, unlike some provisions which say if you open it up or you tear the box, whatever, you can't, but no, you can have 30 days, you can return it. So he says, that explains it. So that is why the limitation of warranty, of which there's no notice of any kind on the box, not even, hey, there's a limitation of warranty inside, the best he can do is say, well, their ads say limited lifetime warranty. That tells us a lot. So I always think about it this way. I always want to say, Judge Easterbrook, let's suppose, I think I gave you this example last class, let's suppose that I've had my Gateway computer for 10 days. And I'm getting along okay with it. I'm still thinking about it. I sort of like it. It's okay. And I get a telephone call from Gateway. Mr. Kalander? Yes. Look, I hate to make this call, I'm really sorry about it, but how are you getting along with our computer? Oh, okay. We're going to charge your credit card an additional 10%. Why? We just raised the price. You can't do that, we had a contract. Oh, no, no, you haven't accepted our contract yet. You're just inspecting it. We don't have a contract for 20 more days. What would you say? What do you think Easterbrook would say? Do you think that he would say that they could do that? I can't believe that.
I was also wondering if I bought an airline ticket and then wanted to return it like an hour before the flight, you said I don't accept the terms of the contract, would they let me do it?
No. Well, it depends upon what kind of ticket you buy. You know, there are two kinds of tickets now. There's a class of tickets you can return, and there's a class of tickets you can't return. So it depends upon the class of ticket it was. He's doing this because there is a problem. There is a problem. Notwithstanding what he has to say about, oh, well, it's just a few words. It's not a few words. Nobody who's bought anything thinks that it's a few words. Sometimes the piece of paper is very small, but the print is even smaller. There are a lot of words, not just a few. And he may say, oh, well, none of them are very important except the warranty. But who's he to judge that? They are all purported terms of the contract. So here's the dilemma. What should we do about that? In a contract system, what should we do about it? And I don't have an easy answer to that. But on the other hand, isn't what he's doing is to say that the seller makes the contract on whatever terms the seller wants to make the contract? That the contract that you think you make, he's saying you don't really make. The contract you think you make is, I bought the box, whatever was in it, and I paid the money. That's what you think is the contract. But he says, that's not the contract. The contract is this other thing that's inside the box. That's the contract. Well, you can't, that makes no sense in terms of everything we know about the law of offer and acceptance. We just tear up everything we studied since January the 20, whatever it was, when we started again. Right? It's all wrong. But it's not wrong. It is still the way in which we make contracts, except that some courts are allowing a contract to be formed in a different way. I mean, how different is this? Let's take a look at the next case. Very interesting case. Chateau des Charmes wines versus Sabati. So here we have a contract in which a Canadian company and a California subsidiary of a French company are making a deal over the purchase and sale of corks to cork bottles of wine. And the buyer is Chateau des Charmes, and they buy these things from Sabate, and they notice something sort of a little, smells a little bit in some of their wines that they've bottled, and they learn that the cork is apparently defective in some fashion or another, and causing their wine to spoil or causing it to get a bad taste. So what's Sabate's argument? Because what they're trying to do is they are trying to insist that this action can only be brought in France, and there is a so-called forum selection clause. But the contract that they make when they were buying, arranging for the purchase and sale of the cork says nothing about forum selection. Where is the forum selection clause? Where? Not in the order form.
Invoice.
In the invoice. When is the invoice generated? When do we see it in life?
When
the goods are delivered. Sometimes the invoice comes even after the goods come. But at the soonest, it comes with the goods. Hey, wait a second. I thought the contract was made when the buyer and seller made the contract and figured out how many corks and for what price and whatever other terms were in that contract, none of which were forum selection. So they now tender a invoice with a forum selection clause. Now, if the court said that forum selection clause was binding, well, that's a little like what Hill versus Gateway does, or Procedure versus Seidenberg. That is, it gives the seller control over the terms of the contract. It's the seller who puts the mysterious language in the box, and it's the seller who creates the invoice. What happened in this case? Did the court find that the forum selection clause was part of the contract or not part of the contract? They said it was not. Okay. But this is a terrible opinion too, because we have to see why they say it was not part of the contract. So this case is decided under the CISG, the UN Convention on the International Sale of Goods. We have a an American buyer and a French seller. The way the CISG works is that the lawyers, when they write the contract, if they want to, they can say, they can dictate what law applies. The CISG says that. But if it's silent as to what law applies, then the CISG applies if the buyer and seller are both citizens of signatory countries, countries that have signed this treaty. Well, Canada and the United States and France, all of us are signatories to the CISG. And these parties did not negate the applicability of CISG, so the CISG is applicable. So the court starts looking at the CISG. And they correctly say that Article 11 says a contract of sale need not be included in or evidenced by writing, not subject to any other requirements to court. Well, that's right. But does that have anything to do with this case? Later on, they say a contract's concluded at the moment when an acceptance of an offer becomes effective. Within such framework, the oral agreements and so on to concord. Okay, fine. So we have a complete binding contract. I'm happy. The next paragraph starts talking about Article 29.1 and Article 19.3. Now, if you were really terrifically diligent, you would have looked those up, but maybe you didn't. So let's look at them now. I don't want to embarrass you by asking how many people looked at Article 19. The reason why I want us to look at Article 19 is that, in truth, Article 19 deals as the CISG equivalent of 2207. Remember 2207? We talked about it last class. That's the battle, the so-called battle of the forms. Oh, by the way, here's another mistake that Easterbrook made. Easterbrook in Procedi versus Zeidenberg says, oh, there the party is cited as the 2207, but 2207 doesn't apply here because this is not a battle of the forms case. 2207 is called the battle of the forms, just the nickname that people give it, that lawyers give it, judges give it. But you know what 2207, all it talks about is an offer and an acceptance. It arises frequently where the offeror is using the offeror's form and the offeree is using the offeree's form, hence the battle of forms. But the language of the provision simply talks about a memorandum which purports to be an acceptance. That's all. An act of acceptance. So, Article 19 starts the same way. Language is a little different. A reply to an offer which purports to be an acceptance but contains additions, limitations, or other modifications. But then what does it give us? It gives us the common law rule. It's a rejection. But it doesn't end there. So they get the two. And they say a reply to an offer which purports to be an acceptance but contains additional or different terms which do not materially alter the terms of the offer, that would be an acceptance. And the only way that the offeror can get out of those terms is by giving notice of objection to the terms. And if he doesn't so object, the terms of the contract or the terms of the offer or the modification contain the acceptance. Incidentally, it's not at all clear what happens if he does not, if he objects to the terms. I believe that the answer should be that there's no contract. Three, additional or different terms relating, among other things, and it then proceeds to list a series of things which it says these are material. These are material. And that's interesting, and that's fine, and it uses it because this is forum selection, and one of the things is provisions on the settlement of disputes. He says that's a forum selection clause, is one of those. But you know something? Is that relevant to this? This has to do with when you have a purported acceptance of an offer and you're trying to figure out whether or not it becomes part of the contract, did we have anything like that here? The court says to us, oh, we have this contract made. It's an oral contract for the purchase and sale of the of corks. And the court tells us it was a complete contract. It was, they were finished. Now we have performance. Well, if what we have is performance, who the hell cares what Article 19 says, which talks about formation of a contract? Well, you can argue that the invoice was, in a way, a contractual act. But if so, what was it? How do we characterize? If we say the contract has already been formed orally for the purchase and sale of corks, and the invoice now contains this terms but has a forum selection term, what is it?
Modification.
Well, it can't be a modification. It takes two to tango, it takes two to modify. So what is it?
Counteroffer.
It's an offer. No, it can't be a counteroffer because there's no offer. It's an offer to modify. Yeah, it's an offer to modify. It's an offer to modify. So I guess what the court really has to talk about is whether when they use the corks, that using of the corks is an acceptance of the offer to modify. Would it be? Well, I think that the invoice came with the corks.
Some came after, I think some. I think some of them came after.
Some of them came before and some came after. But with respect to any of them, would you say that the use of the corks was an acceptance of an offer to modify? We've talked a little bit about this, right? What kind of acceptance would you expect such an offer to get if it was going to be accepted?
It would be an invoice, not the use of the
corks. Well, it would be a written response. It would be a written acceptance, or it could be an oral acceptance, but it would be articulated. This is silence. You can't say that the use of the corks is acceptance because the use of the corks is what the purchase was about. The contract was to get them corks, which they were going to use. Their use of the corks, therefore, can't be treated as an acceptance of an offer. You see, the seller is not in a position to restrict the rights of the buyer to use the goods any way the buyer wants to use the goods. The buyer bought the goods. Now, the seller might be able to restrict it, but if so, they have to restrict it in the contract. But the contract had no restriction in it, and the contract had no choice of form in it. This is an effort to make silence acceptance. That is, there was no response. They didn't say no, therefore they said yes. Well, that's not the law, is it? It's not the CISG, and it's not U.S. law, common law, or statutory either. Yeah.
But isn't there silence sort of undue delay?
No, undue delay? Undue delay? This is a question of whether or not there was a breach of contract. Undue delay in what? In notifying of breach? They notified of a breach as soon as they knew that the corks were defective. They can't notify them that the corks are defective until they know they're defective. Now, I think the court comes out the right way. But the logic of the court is not very good. So how should it be? Well, what it should be is that there was an offer, that the invoice simply contained an offer to modify the contract by including a forum selection clause, and that offer was not accepted by the buyer. All the buyer did was silent with respect to the invoice. And silence doesn't make acceptance unless the relationship of the parties has given rise to a mutual understanding that silence would be acceptance. That's what we learned. That's good law. But the court does come out the right way, so I guess I shouldn't worry too much about it, except that I think it's misleading.
Did either, I see what you're saying, did either party even look at the form selection clause? Is that they were modifying the contract? I thought everyone was coming from the position was that was the contract, but it just wasn't discussed when they made their oral contract.
No, but that may be what they're trying to argue, but we would have to say that's really an offer to modify, because as the court says, they had made the contract. The contract is moot. Otherwise, why were they shipping corks? They were a gift.
Well, see, like, they did have a contract, but because it was oral, the seller, when they were kind of, the invoice acted kind of as the written contract, and that was, but because of the CISG, the oral was okay, they couldn't sneak that term.
Yeah, that's right. There's no statute of frauds. No statute
right.
of frauds in the CISG at all, so it didn't matter that it was oral. But the court doesn't suggest that. The court says that the contract was complete and binding orally. And indeed, in the footnote, they refer to the statute of frauds. They say it's not likely that wouldn't be true in the United States because we'd apply 2201, it's goods more than $500 or more, and therefore it'd have to be a writing, blah, 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 but not under the CISG. So they had an enforceable contract right then and there. So if parties have a contract, and then one of the parties wants to suggest a different term to the contract, that's called an offer to modify. They can't unilaterally change the contract. They can't force, as true of all offerors, you can't force an offeree to speak, and you can't argue that the offeree's silence is acceptance. You couldn't even say that acceptance, taking the corks, represents acceptance of the invoice, even if the invoice had come before the corks had come, because they had a contractual right to take the corks under the existing contract. And therefore, you can't identify their use of the corks as an acceptance of the invoice term.
If they made a counteroffer to have forum selection be in New York and Netscape stayed silent,
All that would happen is there would be no modification. Modification requires an offer and acceptance. If they wanted the counteroffer, that's fine. They could counteroffer and say New York, and then it's up to the French company to say yes. But if the French company is silent, there's no modification. It takes two to modify, just the same way as it takes two to make a contract.
Sabate's position is that they have to come up with that there was some mutual understanding of this, of a modification based on that invoice.
If they wanted to argue that the choice of forum became part of the contract, they're going to have to identify a moment of acceptance of that offer.
And what is that moment?
It doesn't exist. It could exist. It could exist. Sometimes the invoice has a provision for, you know, signing acceptance of the terms of the invoice.
This one
didn't.
But they couldn't come up with, well, by their act of paying the invoice, they accepted the terms that were on.
I don't see how, because they're paying it is consistent with their obligations under the contract. That's what the contract says. The contract says pay on the invoice. Same problem. Keep on coming back to the same thing, yeah. It would require an articulated acceptance, and there was none. Otherwise, you're saying that it's really silence, because everything that they've done as part of their performance of the contract that is described by the court correctly as a complete contract. If it's a complete contract, it can be changed, but it takes two to change it.
But essentially, that's where the defendant's case would have to be a mutual understanding, and they don't have that.
Well, that's why the you know, that's why the court decided, no, there's no forum acceptance clause here. I just am not terribly pleased with the fact that they go around treating this as though they have to subject it to an analysis of whether or not this represents a material change. Because I would maintain it doesn't matter whether it's material. It could be the most immaterial change in the world. It still wouldn't be part of the contract.
If this were decided under the UCC, you think Savate would have a better chance of winning this case? Is there some way the UCC could be used to kind of?
Well, I don't think so, because I think that assuming that the first one was in writing, because we have a statute of frauds issue, so assuming they had put it in writing and that all it talked about was price and whatever else you talk about when you just buy and sell corks and didn't have any provision on form, and then they shipped an invoice. See, the only time some American courts have used the invoice as the contract, they've done that only when they come to the conclusion that what preceded the invoice had not made a completed contract. So that in the battle of forms cases where you have the offer is over here and the acceptance so-called is over here, but there are a variety of differences between the two, some courts, and I think they're wrong, but some courts have said, oh, yeah, but when the seller shipped the goods, they shipped them with an invoice and the buyer accepted the goods under that invoice, so that's the contract. But notice, they weren't treating that as a modification of some other contract that was formed. They're saying there wasn't any other contract, so this is the contract. A very different circumstance. Here, the court was saying there was a contract. Okay, let's look at spec. I'm sorry. Yeah?
I was just wondering, under the UCC, again, like, is there ever a circumstance where someone can make an immaterial modification unilaterally?
Well, unilateral. Well, yes, under 2207, it's not regarded as a modification. Under 2207, what happens is the seller, let's say the seller makes an let's do it the other way. The buyer makes an offer. The offer, let's say, does not contain any forum selection clause. Well, that's not a good one because maybe that's material. Let's suppose it's not material for the moment. The offer includes some immaterial provision. The offeree responds with what looks like an acceptance, but it has a different provision. If they are both merchants, that becomes part of the contract. Unless the offeror objects to it.
The offeree's acceptance with the modification becomes the contract.
What happens is it's not a modification at that point, because we're really talking about 2207 deals with the initial formation of a contract.
I got you.
Doesn't talk about modification. Okay, let's look at spec versus Netscape Communications. You notice that one of the judges who decided this, in addition to Pierre Laval, read his decisions before, but that other judge, oh yeah, Sotomayor, you know who she is. She now sits on the Supreme Court of the United States. Okay, so here we have a problem of not a box delivery, but instead we have a problem of opportunity to contract over the internet by downloading. For some of you who don't remember the history of browsers, Netscape was the second browser written and still exists, although not in the same form and not written by the same people. It was a very good browser. It got killed because when Microsoft decided belatedly that, gee, maybe this internet was not going to blow over, maybe it was actually going to be important, something which appalled them, I think it still does. And so they decided they would write a browser, which they did. They actually bought it from somebody, and they then gave it away. And Netscape was a company that was making its money by selling its software. And so Internet Explorer killed the Netscape browser. They went through a series of corporate changes and gradually disappeared down the drain. How do you contract when you're selling over the software over the internet? What did they do wrong here? What was wrong? What failed about the way in which they tried to create a contractual relationship with a customer?
Did it make the area where they could accept the terms conspicuous enough for the user to see it before proceeding with the download?
Where was it?
Is it was on the bottom, or I guess in some corner? It was difficult to see.
The magic word here is below. Magic word is below. Don't put the word accept, the button accept, don't put it. Don't put the language below that. Where should it be? At the bottom. At the bottom. Careful software writers, and there aren't too many of them, careful coders with lawyers who are really worried about this, will require that you scroll through the entire license, however long that may be, before you find the word accept and before it is an active button. You can't get there. You can't accept until after you scroll the entire page. Others, of course, do not. Others, when you go to accept it, when you haven't scrolled through the entire page, a window drops down and says, oh, well, do you agree with everything? okay, so what they did wrong here is they understood that they wanted to impose some terms, and they had some of the terms, but not all, for whatever reason. I think that it was just aesthetics, right? So they had a screen full of stuff, and they thought, okay, well, we'll put the word accept on the first screen so people don't have to continue scrolling. That was a mistake. So the court says, not good enough. You didn't put it in the right place. They made a lot of interesting arguments, and none of them, you notice, were at all availing. The issue they were arguing about, of course, was, again, an arbitration clause. They were trying to enforce an arbitration clause. The arbitration clause was one of the bits of the language that was below the line, below the button. And so the customer argued that they were not limited by arbitration. And the court says, well, even though the Arbitration Act says that if the parties say, the contract says arbitration, then we have to order arbitration, we can't litigate it. The one exception to that is if the party's arguing that there was no valid arbitration clause in the agreement, it was not part of the contract, then of course that we can litigate because that says the purported arbitration clause was not part of the contract, so therefore we shouldn't be sending it to arbitration. And that's what the court did. That's what this court did. And poor Netscape, they tried everything. They had in variety of places the same language. But the trouble was that none of it was where it had to be, which is part of the smart download package, that you would have clicked the word I agree after you had passed by the provision about going to arbitration. Along the way, though, it's kind of interesting to see what the court says about all of us. My favorite is, over on page 682, defendants argue that plaintiffs must be held to a standard of reasonable prudence and that because notice of the existence of smart download license terms was on the next scrollable screen, plaintiffs were on inquiry notice of these terms. That is, when you look at it, you could see that there's a scroll bar, and after all, if you're reasonably prudent, you don't just click on I agree. I mean, you scroll down to see what's below it. And the court says, are you kidding? Who does that? Which is probably right. So they exclude that. One of the cases, of course, that Netscape cites, because everybody cites to it, is Procedi versus Zeidenberg. And the court says, no, we don't think the Procedi has anything to do with this at all. This is not a case where we're arguing that that the party became aware of it as part of the contract formation. Remember, that's sort of what Easterbrook says, that when Matt Zeidenberg sat down, plugged the disc in on the splash screen, the first thing he saw was the license agreement, which said that you may not make it available on the internet. And Easterbrook says that's really part of the contract formation as he sees it, because it was during the period at which Zeidenberg could return it. And he says that's not what this is at all. This is not that. Well, I guess it's not. I mean, if the court tells it's not, but it's awful close. I think that it represents a court that is really kind of skeptical about the way in which Easterbrook went about deciding Procedi versus Zeidenberg and Hill versus Gateway, which they also cite in this decision. Everybody's got this about right now. I mean, I don't think that I've run into a software license in the last 5 years that got this wrong. And everybody's learned how to do it, and the word agree is always after everything else, or is written in a way which has you acknowledge that you've read everything. So if it's somewhere else on another page, that you acknowledge that you've read it. So that makes it kind of hard to go into court and say, well, it's true, Your Honor, that I clicked on the button and said I acknowledge that I read the terms of the license, and then I have to tell you I didn't. Then I do run into the reasonably prudent person problem, right? A reasonably prudent person does not say, oh yeah, I've read it all, when you haven't read it. So I think that probably it does the trick. Okay, let's look at Register versus Verio. One of my favorite issues. The practices of ICON have changed. I don't know whether any of you have any registered names. Registered internet names now. I have numbers of them. Now you can actually pay your registrar, the register, to hide your personal information, the information that is required. They have to have that information under federal law. They have to have your name, they have to have your address, both the person who owns it and also, if it's somebody different, the person who manages it. Both of those have to be there with contact information. But you're allowed to hide it. The register is allowed to hide it, so the registers have now taken this as a way of making additional money, so they charge you to hide it. But when Verio was doing what it was doing, register.com and all the other registers had to collect that information, and the information was public. Anybody could find it just by doing a whois. If you've never done a whois, you should try it. It's kind of fun. You do it from the terminal line or from the start, wherever you reach the command line in Windows under start, and run whois, and then just give the address. You know, whois. www.law.wnac.edu, for example, and you will find that it will respond with some information about who owns the that name, that internet name. So Verio did a smart thing. They just created a robot, and the robot went repeatedly to register.com site. That was at the point that there were only, I think, two registers doing all the internet name registration in the world. Now we have many, many of them, but at the time there were only two or three. Network Solutions, Register, and that was it for a long time. So the robot collected names and addresses. And that prompted, they would then send email, send direct mail, offering their services to help create a website, to help create and promote a website using that name. It's a good way of doing business. The trouble was that Register.com said, yes, but it violates our arrangements. We have a rule that says you may not do that. We have a rule that says you may not do that. And they say, oh, well, you only told me about that rule after I got the information. What does the court say?
They said, yeah, maybe once or twice you can make that argument and we would agree with you, but you did, were there multiple times a day for many, many days or however long they did it. You can't claim that. You got to see it at some point.
That's right. This is one of my favorite metaphors. You don't find very many of these in court making little stories. Situation might be compared to one in which Plaintiff P maintains a roadside fruit stand displaying bins of apples. A visitor, Defendant D, takes an apple and bites into it. As D turns to leave, D sees a sign, visible only as one turns to exit, which says apples, 50 cents apiece. D does not pay for the apple. D believes he has no obligation to pay because he had no notice when he bit into the apple that 50 cents was expected in return. D's view is that he never agreed to pay for the apple. Therefore, each day, several times a day, D revisits the stand, takes an apple, and eats it. D never leaves money. And the court says, that's just not right. Because when he came back the second time, he knew that the apples were for sale and you were supposed to pay 50 cents a piece. And he says to Verio, you knew that you had to pay 50 cents. You knew that. You knew that you had to follow the rules that were insisted upon by Register. So obviously there are other ways in which Register.com could have done this, so it's interesting to think about it. What would you do? Suppose you were Register.com's lawyer, and you thought, just as a matter of the commitments you make to people with whom you do business, those are the people who come in and buy names from you. And so you want to be able to assure them that you will not give out their names and that you have a requirement that everybody comply with a set of rules. And one of those rules is you can't just gather names and addresses from people who register names and then send them promotional material. What could they do? What they did do, you saw, right? So after every request for that information, they said, hey, there are limits on how you can use the information. And then they wanted to argue, as Verio argued, well, you only told me that after I had it, but I already had it, and therefore I can use it. So what else could you do?
They only put it as a disclaimer. They never had, Verio, I don't believe, had to say, I agree that I will.
Right, that's exactly right. And so what you do, and you do it, you remember, what? And you use Facebook, I assume a bunch of you do. Out of these social network, social companies that run social networks, how do they do this? Answer, they create what they call terms of service. And before you can make use of it, when you very first sign up, it happened so quickly you probably paid no attention to the terms of service at all, but they had a list of terms of service and you had to say, I agree. The company that is the most aggressive about this, by the way, I don't know how many of you use iTunes, either on Mac or Windows, but Apple they redo their terms of service with some frequency, and every time they make even the smallest change in a term of service, they won't let you visit the iTunes store until you agree to the terms of service, which are by now getting very long. That's right.
But although the court didn't accept it, but...
Well, the court said, yeah, but once you knew the limitation, you knew it. You know, in a way, if you remember back to that wonderful department store offer in which they offer a fur, right, first come, first serve, and when he shows up, they say, you know, you're a man, this is only being offered to a woman. And he says, well, he shows up a second time, and he says, yeah, but the ad didn't say it. The court says, it's not impressed. But they did. They didn't do it right. There's no doubt about it. They would have been better off if they had created a structure in which, in order to use the site, you had to agree to a term of service. That would have required that you had to log in every time you come to the site. Now, there are some sites that don't want to do that, and register.com is one of them. They don't want you to have to register to visit the site. That's their problem. Well, that's because they want you to they hope that maybe if you get comfortable with them, maybe you'll buy a name from them. And now they're actually in the business of web page development, so they hope that maybe you'll stay and ask them to develop your web page for you, for a fee, of course. But they only require that you log in when you want to buy a name. Nevertheless, they could have done it by having a terms of service that you have to agree to when you first come in. Now, that means that you got to create a login procedure. And I think that they just didn't want to do it, and they still haven't done it. They still have no login procedure. Now, the problem with all of this, let's step back and get a little perspective about this. So what we're talking about now is that in modern life, we obviously make contracts in which the model of how we deal with the formation of the contract does not exactly echo the initial expectations of a contract system. You ever stop and think, what was in their mind when they have offer and acceptance? Well, among other things, they had in mind, right, two identified people who knew each other, at least for business purposes, and either were writing to each other or they were talking to each other. And they weren't assuming that they were done based on forms. Obviously, there were no electronics. They weren't assuming that there could be questions like, what do you put in the box as compared to what do you say in the contract? We have a system of contracting which simply doesn't fit terribly well with the way in which business is done today. And what we're seeing is courts struggling with that and now trying to do what? Well, they're trying to achieve what the rules of offer and acceptance originally sought to achieve, which was some kind of balance between the two parties. So in the traditional rules of offer and acceptance, you find the balance in the fact that the offeror gets to design the offer, gets to decide what all the terms are, but the offeree gets to say yes or no. They get to create the commitment. It's just an offer, has no legal effect at all until the offeree says yes. So there's kind of a balance between the offeror and the offeree. Now the problem is, how do we achieve that kind of balance when we talk about, well, let's see, the terms of the deal are going to be in the box and that's the only sensible place for them to be? Easterbrook is right when he says, you know, that at least for the sale of goods, he's not right actually in this case because it doesn't apply to software, but he says that we have a federal law which says, Magnuson Moss, which says that every seller of consumer goods has to have make available on request their warranty. But the problem is, that's not very realistic. And so therefore he says, oh yeah, so it was available, he could have asked for it. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But I could just imagine now, you want to go shopping for a television set, right? And you're not sure, you know, it could be a Sony, LG, you know, there are about 12 manufacturers of TV sets these days. And you're not sure. So what you do, of course, is you write to each one and say, send me your warranty, and then you study the warranties before you go shopping. No, you're not going to do that. You're not going to do that. After you buy one, it's important to you, of course, what limitations there may be in the warranty, in your ability to argue that they have done something that is improper, incorrect. But it's in the box, and you don't see it until after you make the contract. So the courts are wrestling with this question of how do we cope with contract formation in this world? And so while I'm critical of things that Easterbrook and others say that don't make a lot of sense in terms of contract principle, and they're trying to twist it, right, to make it work somehow, and it really doesn't. But the reason that they're twisting it to make it work is the consequences of applying the traditional offer and acceptance rules are themselves unacceptable, probably, in our environment. So I'm going to say to a television manufacturer, you may not, you know, spell out the terms of your warranty arrangements inside the box. If you want them to be part of the contract, where are you going to write them? Write them on the outside of the box. Of course, the irony about this is you probably make your decision to buy the TV before you ever see the box, because what's on the shelf is the TV. Okay, here's a good idea. You'll write it on the TV. Well, that's not a very good idea. So, you'll see.
I was just thinking, with the speed of business on the internet, it's not even reasonable for one to read all the terms you come across in a day. I mean, you may come across like 30 terms of agreement in a day with just a normal mode of doing business on the computer. It's impossible to read them all.
That's right.
I mean, if in the process of doing business.
That's right. Absolutely right.
So I wonder how courts will do it.
And if you can read them, you would probably not understand half of what they say in any event, right? Insurance policies are my favorite example. I mean, everybody ought to read every word in the insurance policy. I don't know anybody who reads all the words in insurance policy, including the insurance brokers who never read the language insurance policy. That I can assure you.
Do you think that maybe, why didn't Easterbrook just say, okay, this contract doctrine does not, you know, help proceed here, the legislature should make a new law?
Because he's a Seventh Circuit judge. And what's he doing that? Maybe the Supreme Court of the state could do that, right? But what's his basis for doing it? Under Erie, he's supposed to be applying state law. But could judges fashion it? Nobody's done it yet. I mean, we don't have those yet. So we don't read any of these, but about the best that some courts have done is to do this. This is an interesting twist, but then it's really a little weird as a matter of contract law, but maybe it's going to have to be. They say that all the terms that are contained inside the box, all the terms are binding, they become part of the contract. They don't do it the way Easterbrook did, by saying, well, there's a right of return, and therefore not returning it, you accept. They just say, it's in the box, it's part of the contract. Except that if there are any of the provisions are unexpected, that's the term most of them use, if they're unexpected, then they're not part of the contract. Which is to say, it's kind of a almost unconscionability approach. Right? It's we, the court, have the right to declare what is in or not in the contract, and we'll use as our standard whether it's a clause that a reasonable buyer would have expected to be there. So you got a New Jersey case, for example, that has a provision that's in a, I can't remember what they were buying, some machine. And the provision says that arbitration is in London. You have to go to London to arbitrate. And the court says, look, an arbitration clause people expect to see. Arbitration in London, the sale was in New Jersey. Arbitration in London, you don't expect to see it. We're not going to enforce it. And by the way, we're not going to enforce arbitration at all because the only word of arbitration was arbitration in England, so they deleted the clause. So if it had said arbitration in New Jersey, presumably the court would have said, oh, that's okay, we'll enforce it. Even though, of course, the buyer had no idea when they bought it that they couldn't litigate against the seller if, let's say, their home was destroyed by some malfunction of the device that they bought. Okay, we'll do a little bit more with this, but mostly we'll be moving on to the next assignment. All the assignments for the rest of the term, except for the two classes, which are marked TBA, but all the other assignments are up, and we will try and stay on that schedule as best we can.